And welcome back to OT Insights from Classroom to Clinic. I'm Liana.
Cynthia.
Emmy.
Sam.
And today we are here with two very special guests, Dr. April Cowan and Dr. Reagan Blankenship. As students at UTMB, we have been very lucky to have been taught by both Dr. Cowan and Dr. Blankenship in our time here. And today we're going to chat about their careers as occupational therapists and professors, their opinions on the field of OT and its areas of growth, as well as their advice for students who are interested in occupational therapy. So, without further ado, we first want to hear about both of you. Could you please tell our listeners where you went to school, how long you've been an OT, and your area of specialty?
Hello, I'm April Cowan, and I have been an occupational therapist for 34 years. And I went to my undergrad degree is from the University of Texas Medical Branch, so I'm alumna. And my doctoral degree is from Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Utah. And my area of practice is the upper extremity and hand therapy.
Beautiful.
Hi, I am Reagan Blankenship. I have been an occupational therapist for 11 years now. I got my undergrad at Spalding University in Louisville, Kentucky, and that's also where I got my master's in occupational therapy. I later went to the University of Indianapolis, where I received my doctorate of health science. My specialty has been in pediatrics and upper extremity hand and pediatrics.
Thank you both again for being here today. I wanted to first start off by asking you both, what drew you to OT?
For me, it was actually way back in high school when I was in a class called Health Professions, where they indoctrinated us to the different allied health professions and also medical professions in general, and then tried to arrange learning experiences where you would learn about the professions and how you might pursue them. Having said that, I did come to a program here in Galveston between my junior and senior years of high school where they taught us about the different health professions. And at that time, I was lucky enough to meet a man named Robert Bing, who is like the father of occupational therapy, if you will. And he really made me believe that I already knew I couldn't go to medical school. I couldn't make those life or death decisions. I did want to work in healthcare, but he really led me to believe that I was not the physical therapist that I thought that I wanted to be, and that occupational therapy really fit my skill set and those things that I wanted to be able to do for individuals.
I feel like my story is definitely not as cool as Dr. Cowan's. Being able to meet and know Robert Bing, I mean, that's pretty amazing. I feel like my story is nowhere near as cool. But for me, growing up, I was a gymnast, and I ended up with a career-ending injury where I tore my Achilles tendon. And at that time, you know, I was pretty devastated, but it actually is what brought me to the field of OT, because whenever I first went to my physical therapy for my recovery, my mom didn't know the difference between like a pediatric physical therapist and an orthopedic physical therapist. And so I ended up at a pediatric clinic, and they originally told me there was no way they could help me because that's not what they really were doing. But at that time, I was able to see an OT, and I watched an OT in the corner playing with a little kiddo, and from that moment on, I said, okay, that's what I want to do. Like, that is the coolest job. And it's something that, you know, I could see this kiddo just having the time of his life. Or they were on a scooter board and just doing some fun stuff. And I didn't know what it was at that time. But I asked, and, you know, from then on, I was 13 at that time. I knew that's what I wanted to do. So knew pretty early on that I wanted to be a pediatric OT. And here I am.
Thank y'all both so much. And now we're going to talk a little bit about y'all's experience in the clinic. Can you both share a memorable experience that you've had with a client or patient?
As I mentioned, I work in hand and upper extremity. And so I think back to one of my most complex patients ever was an individual who had managed to have his hand pulled through a table saw. And so he essentially had almost a complete amputation of his hand about mid-palm region. So all of the body systems were involved. But the plastic surgeons were able to reattach his hand. And I just remember after working, we worked together for several years, but finally at the very end, he was actually starting to be able to grip things and pick things up and manipulate buttons and small objects with the hand that he had nearly completely lost. And I like to feel like I had a small piece of that recovery for him.
You know, it's hard to pick a single story that really
has impacted, really, I mean, I would say us the most. So many of our patients touch our hearts and continue to be with us even long after their therapy sessions are over, long after they graduate from therapy, or, you know, just long after they re-enter and no longer need us, because that really is that ultimate goal, is that they can graduate from therapy and be able to go out and live their lives. But for me, specifically this one little kiddo, trying to keep a long story short, but the family was pretty much told that their child was never going to be able to do a lot of things, that because of the damage done to his brain, he wasn't going to be able to talk, he wasn't going to be able to walk, he wasn't going to be able to really participate, and just kind of gave them this sense of that their child wasn't going to be able to be a kid. And with therapy, and I started working with him when he was 3 months old, and by the time he was two, he was walking, he was talking, we were at the point where we were actually working on coloring, he was dressing himself, he was being able to participate in a lot of his ADLs, which are the activities of daily living, and just being able to be a kid. And that's, you know, just one small story, but, you know, I think most therapists have those stories that just continue with them.
So it's very clear that you guys have both made such an amazing impact in the lives of your patients. Have there been any moments where you guys have faced challenges throughout the field, and how did you overcome these challenges?
Certainly, I've been an occupational therapist for a fairly long time, but I do remember a time when I had to justify my existence on the healthcare team, what I was doing that was different or special than any other member of the team. And so there definitely is an importance to having that elevator speech, if you will, how you describe your profession and what you bring to the table. I can say, as I look around me now, I just don't think it's as much of a challenge as it used to be, that having to justify your role and responsibilities within the team.
Yeah, I definitely second that. You know, I've been a therapist for, you know, over a decade, but, you know, I've seen the profession grow, and I've seen the advocacy that a lot of therapists are really pushing for. And with the help of social media and with the help of just the internet, more people are understanding what OT actually is and what we do and what makes our job different than physical therapist or from developmental therapist or from speech therapist. And now whenever I tell someone that I'm occupational therapist, I don't get the, what do you mean? You help people with jobs? I don't get that as much as what I used to. Or whenever I told people when I was 15 years old that I wanted to be an OT when I grew up, and they were like, what is that? I don't know what that is. More people now know. Whereas before, I think you had to have had an experience with OT for you to know what OT meant. And so, yeah, I don't think, I really don't have a whole lot of need to say and advocate for my profession as much as what previously I've had to, because people know what we do. But that's not to say that there's still not a need for advocacy, because there really is. There's still a need for advocacy for our patients and for our clients to be able to receive the services that we can provide.
I think that's very refreshing to hear as new OTs that our profession has come such a long way. Are there other ways that y'all can think of that we as baby OTs can advocate for our profession?
Definitely just being willing to stand up for yourself and stand up for what's right and what you believe in. You know, not losing your professional demeanor, but still being able to get your point across and express the value of OT.
What you guys are doing right now is a great way to advocate for our profession and just show just the cool thing. I mean, being an OT is cool. Like, we have a really cool job, and more people need to know about that. We're a growing profession, but we're still a needed profession. The number of OTs that are needed are only going to continue to grow as the population ages. And it's something that we need more people to come into our field. We need those people to come. And what you guys are doing and trying to get OT out there is something what you can do now. And just whenever there's the opportunity to educate about our profession, do so. And that really can help to continue to grow the profession and continue to advocate for what we do.
Okay, so y'all talked about advocating for your profession to other healthcare professionals. And we hear a lot about interprofessional collaboration, and that's like something that we learn learn in our interprofessional education. Do you have any standout interprofessional experiences that you've had with other healthcare or medical professions like PTs or PAs or nurses or doctors, and how have those experiences changed the quality of care of your patients?
I think the reality is that the majority of healthcare is done in a healthcare teams type of format, if you will. When I was a baby OT, maybe the teams weren't as strong. As I go out and practice in the clinic now, definitely there's are always other disciplines that I'm working with, and I do think it is to the benefit of the patient. I think that it's less likely that needs or issues fall by the wayside, or there's not someone that knows how to address that specific issue. Again, I do think that the teams are larger. From my perspective, it helped me to grow and develop as a professional to be able to tell other disciplines what work or what I can bring to the table. I think it makes me a stronger clinician for my patients, and that I'm less likely to omit or miss things that might be apparent. Really always a positive experience, I think.
Definitely second that. With there's always a team, and if it's not another healthcare professional that you are collaborating with, then it's the caregivers, it's the family, it's not just healthcare professionals in that team. But you know, right now my best friend is a speech therapist. Another one of my really great friends is a physical therapist, and they were all people that I've worked together with, and we've worked with patients together, and just you form that relationship. I know that if I'm working with a patient that I feel maybe there's something else that we're missing, I can reach out to a colleague, I can reach out to another person on the team and tell them what it is that I'm seeing, and then we can help get help for that patient. And that's really the way that our healthcare profession or the healthcare system should be founded on, is by a collaborative team. There's never only one person in an operating room. There's never one person that is working with a patient. You have a whole team to be able to provide that best care. And so that's kind of the way that I look at for therapy as well. It's a team effort, and that's really the best way for all of our clients and our patients.
Absolutely. I love hearing that, because we learn so much in school that like being a part of a team is such a huge thing for healthcare professions, right? Because we have to be able to collaborate to provide the best care for our patients. And so I'm actually going to kind of switch us over and put on your professor hat, if you will, like like one of our professors likes to say. I'm going to ask you some questions about the academia side of things. So what made you decide to pursue academia, and what do you enjoy the most about it?
If I can be perfectly honest, I had gotten to a point in my career where I was a little bit complacent. I was kind of going through the motions of doing my job and not really enjoying it as much as I wanted to. I don't think I was doing a disservice to any of the individuals that I worked with, whether patients or healthcare providers, but I really needed something new. So I decided that more education would make me happier. And so I pursued an advanced degree. And then once you get the advanced degree, what do you do with it? You don't just leave it hanging on the wall or like I did in a cardboard mailer, but you know, you should use it. And so I reached out to UTMB. I had done some contract work previously teaching in labs, but I reached out and I said, you know, I have this school debt now, and if you have any, you know, contract work for me, I'd really be glad to do some teaching for you. And at that time, the chair of the department, Dr. Patricia Fingerhut, said, well, what do you think about a full-time position? And so I sat with my husband. We made a traditional SWOT analysis, what was good, what was going to be bad, that the positives outweighed the negatives in it, and here I am.
My route to academia was a little bit different. You know, I decided to go back to school to pursue my higher education and get my DHS. My goal was to be able to get into research. I really wanted to be a research therapist. I wanted to dive more into research. I wanted to research my goals were the patients that I was treating and be able to do my own treatment methods. But I quickly learned that wasn't really a possibility, being a full-time clinician. And I knew eventually my end goal was going to be academia. And the more students that I received as a level two fieldwork coordinator or a level two fieldwork supervisor, then the more that I realized that's where I wanted to be. And so I started to apply and started as an adjunct professor here at UTMB before switching into the full-time faculty position. And, you know, honestly, it was probably the best decision that I could have made. And I've loved being able to teach students and be able to watch you all grow in your profession of OT and just watch that knowledge blossom.
Yes, absolutely. And we've loved having you as professors, so we're glad that y'all both made the decision to go into academia, because seriously, professors are what make our schooling experience. And so we're very glad that we were able to have you. Dr. Cowan, you mentioned that you have some certifications and some like further education that you did. And I believe, Dr. Blankenship, you also have some extra certifications. Do y'all mind expanding on those just a little bit for us?
My advanced or specialty certification is in hand therapy. So it means that I've pursued advanced training in the area of management for the upper quadrant. So really from the cervical spine to the fingertips, it does require you to do preparatory training and education, and then you take an examination, much like the registration examination for occupational therapy. And then to maintain that certification every 5 years, you have to have a certain amount of upper extremity specific continuing education. So you log your continuing education. If you let it lapse, actually, you have to take the exam again. So I'm on a mission to keep my education current.
Oh, I would too.
Yeah, we all say after our MBCOT, I'm not going to do another test. And then we all end up doing another test again at some point in time just to continue, because that's like what our profession is. Like, we need to continue to grow. We're growing with the times. We're growing with the research. We're growing with the evidence that supports us and supports our profession. So I specialize in neuropediatrics, specifically with children with unilateral cerebral palsy. And that's like where my research is in. And there's not really a need for like an additional certification for that, but I have done training and gone and did a week-long training in Virginia on that. And that's really what kind of expanded my knowledge on upper extremity CP. And then also there's the board certification in pediatrics. I am planning actually to sit for that exam. I just have to talk myself into wanting to sit down again for another exam, even though, you know, the MBCOT was a long time ago. I still feel like I have flashbacks of it and flashbacks of just sitting there for 4 hours. Most OTs are, we're not sitting down people. It's hard for us to sit down for that long. But yeah, it's a similar thing. There's so many different certifications that are out there that OTs can get, because there's just so many different specialties that OTs can have. So you can be a specialist in upper extremity hands, so you're certified hand therapist licensed. You can be a board certification in pediatrics. You can do lymphedema. You can do prosthetics, and you can do robotics. I've had experience in prosthetic and upper limb from that area. And then also you can be an ATP, which is assisted technology practitioner, where you can help with speech devices, you can help with wheelchairs, you can help with any type of adaptive equipment. Additionally, there are, I'm trying to think of other certification courses off the top of my head right now. I feel like I'm blanking on them. But there's a lot of different options out there for OTs. And if it's something that you're passionate about, you can find your niche and you can get into it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you bring that up, because that's one of my favorite things about occupational therapy, is that I feel like the opportunities are endless. You know, you can pursue a specific specialty and then you decide you want to become a professor. But then as a professor, you know, we're always told we're lifelong learners, right? So as a professor, then you can go back. I think you still have to keep clinical hours. Is that correct? Could you expand a little bit on that, as far as like, I know there's continuing education units, but I know that I've heard from several of our professors that while they're teaching us, they're still going to the clinic maybe one time a week to see a patient here or there, just, you know, keep up with, you know, practicing the actual profession. So if you don't mind expanding on that a little bit.
Well, I don't think you have to see a specific number of patients to maintain your license. So I don't think you necessarily have to have clinical work to maintain your license, but you do have to have continuing education. And there are varying rules. I think for the state right now, it's 30 hours every 2 years. You know, for the HT credential, it's 80 hours over 5 years, and it has to be really specific to the upper extremity. Now, you can double dip. You can count your continuing ed across the two different sources, the state and then the national organization. You know, it really only keeps you a strong clinician. That lifelong learning just keeps you doing the best job that you possibly can and keeps your skills current and up to date.
I miss my babies. I miss my little ones. So it's nice to be able to keep up and have at least a few patients that you still see. Just like Dr. Cowan was saying, to keep up with that clinical reasoning. And that's something that I know we really talk a lot about in academia and to teach in teaching is that clinical reasoning piece. And it's really easy once you get out of it to not necessarily lose it, but you start to see it in a different way. And our profession is constantly evolving. We're constantly getting new research out there. There are new treatment methods. There are new treatment approaches. And really, whenever we chose this profession to be able to do good. And whenever you see these things, you want to try them out. Like, you want to see, because it's cool. Like I said, our profession is just really cool. So it's nice to be able to do those things. And with the continuing education courses, there are some universities, depending upon the state, depending upon the specific university, that does require their professors to do clinic hours, but it's not like a need. It's not a requirement from UTMB specifically. It's not a requirement, but other universities, I know that it is a requirement. Some of my friends that are with other institutions are required to keep up clinical hours and clinical skills.
Gotcha. Thank you so much. So of course, our goal of this podcast is to have incoming students, current students, you know, just people that are interested in the occupational profession. But I wanted to see if you had any advice for students that are interested in pursuing your specific area of specialty that you have, as far as like what to do in school, if there's like ways that they should get involved, just any advice you might have for them, even current students like ourselves who are going into our level 2 field work or potentially going into the workforce soon, just advice in general on kind of pursuing the areas of specialty that y'all have mentioned.
In hand therapy, one of the current challenges is finding level 2 fieldwork sites that will take students that don't have a strong background already in hand therapy services. So having said that, I would capitalize on shadowing and volunteer opportunities in hand therapy settings to pick up some of those skill sets, to also really make sure that you pay attention in anatomy and kinesiology and the musculoskeletal type courses, because that is all information that you will utilize. And then lastly, I would say, make sure you practice those things. You know, you can have an interest in something, but if you don't practice it, you're only going to get so far. So I would say, if given the opportunity, jump in and try some of those things, or ask for clarity or explanations for people or demonstrations or guided practice.
Going a step further, too, is like asking for a mentor. Try to find someone who will mentor you. Some of the concerns that I see from new grads who try to get into a pediatric specialty is they don't really realize the complexity of the profession, specifically on the different settings that you can be in for pediatrics. Our cases are sometimes very complex, and it's nice to be able to have someone that you can go to that is a mentor that can help you and that can guide you. 'Cause in your university, like in your studies, we can only give you so much. We can only give you as much time as what we have in a one semester. And believe me, that's not enough, because we've been therapists for a long time and we're still learning and we're still growing. There are still cases that I've come across after 11 years that I've never seen before. And so being that lifelong learner and being willing to say, I don't know. And that's okay. It's okay to say, I don't know. I need to look that up. Like, if you kind of go in with that mindset of like a know-it-all mindset, it's really going to hinder your ability to be a better therapist and to kind of push forward. So being willing to say, I don't know, let me go look that up, or let me go find a mentor, or find someone who has treated this condition or someone who has had experience in this area. Because if I was a parent, or if I was someone or a doctor that I'm sending you this case, if you're willing to say, I'm going to do the research and put forth the effort, it's really going to help you and give you a leg up on others.
Yeah, absolutely. Mentorship is huge. I know that in school alone, we have mentors that we look to from the cohorts above us. And then hopefully in the future, we'll just continue to find someone that can, you know, give us that advice that we need. Dr. Blankenship, you mentioned OT being cool. So is there any kind of intervention that both of y'all can answer this, that you just think is super interesting and really cool and you want to share about it? Because, I mean, that, like you said, that's part of OT, is that it's fun and we get to use a lot of creativity in the activities that we do with our patients. So, yeah, we'd love for you to share if there's one or two interventions that you can explain through a podcast.
Man, that's hard. It's hard to explain what we do without doing it. But for me, being a constraint-induced movement therapy interventionist and working with children with unilateral CP, that's an intervention that it is near and dear to my heart. It's a motor learning type of theory where patients are casted on their unaffected upper extremity, so like that dominant hand, and where they learn how to use their affected upper extremity or that non-dominant hand to perform activity. So we can strengthen the neuroplasticity of the brain. I don't want to speak in a whole lot of therapy terms, but where we can work on reconnecting those pathways and teaching kids how to use their upper extremity and how to use that arm more effectively. So then that way, whenever that cast comes off, they can work on bimanual hand skills, work on using both of those hands together, because that really helps them not just in their activities of daily living, but it also is shown to help with core strengthening. It helps with gross motor. It helps with speech. It's one of those interventions that is a whole body intervention, even though you're really focusing on just the upper extremity. That's just one, but there are so many other really cool interventions that us as OTs can do.
I'm very much a biomechanical or musculoskeletal therapist, so that's where my interventions are going to lie. But as I think about it in this moment, I'm currently supervising on a level one experience, and it's always interesting, first off, to help the students understand that we don't just do exercises or we don't just do occupations, that it typically takes a series of interventions in order to hit that end goal or that outcome that the person is desiring, that increase in function that they want. So, you know, I like teaching about physical agent modalities. Lately, we've been speaking a lot about how do you then incorporate occupations but still achieve the same range of motion short-term objective that you have. So that's kind of where my mind is right now as far as interventions.
Very cool. You know, the first thing that comes to my mind when I think of you, Dr. Cowan, is all the orthotic making that we get to do in your class. And I would say that that's pretty cool and pretty fun. For those that don't know, one of the things that we can do as occupational therapists is fabricate customized orthotic devices for our patients, which is a little bit tricky at times, but it is fun once you get past the frustration, right?
Well, I think the jury might be out as to whether or not it's actually a fun intervention or a fun activity, but we do spend about 6 weeks learning how to do it. And I would agree with you. I think that it is a fun intervention.
I second that. It's only really not fun when you're trying to do it on a thrashing 3-year-old who's screaming at you because they don't want you to put anything on their arm. But you get through it.
That's awesome. Okay, so I think my next question for y'all, and it's kind of similar to what we touched on earlier, but just from the professor lens, when you're looking at students and incoming students, is there any advice that you would give them as far as like classroom, just what to study, or I don't know, just like ways to act even? I don't know the best way to word it, but just like advice as incoming students who haven't been in that grad school experience yet, and then looking at that through the professor lens.
Well, I think for grad school, you have to pace yourself, right? You can't get behind at the very beginning. So I would say, you know, do your readings as much as possible, do your assignments as much as possible. But I really think that sometimes for students, there's a hesitancy to ask questions or to ask for the information that you need. You know, sometimes I put on my thinking face, and I think that that deters people from asking questions, but you should still try to be assertive enough to ask those questions and get the information that you seek. You know, it's always better, too, to say, well, I think I heard you say this, but I'm thinking this way. That way I understand where you're at, and it helps me to formulate the response that will help you move forward.
Yeah, definitely. And coming prepared, like being prepared to class, because that really allows you to ask those questions. if you already know an outline of what the topic is going to be, if you do the readings, if you look ahead at the PowerPoint presentations, if you really prepare yourself for the classroom, you'll be able to format questions that are going to continue to guide that learning and really help to expand upon the skill or the knowledge that you're gaining in the classroom. And then also come in with an open mind. I think that's really a big one. You know, whenever I went into OT school, I knew I wanted to do pediatrics. I was like, I'm going to be a pediatric OT. But then I fell in love with hand and upper extremity, and neuro. I fell in love with those things. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe I need to change my mind a little bit. But come in with an open mind, because maybe you have this framework on what you saw whenever you did your observation hours, or maybe you have a family member who's an OT and that's where you think you want to end up. But school is that opportunity for you to experience different options in OT. So just really come in with an open mind and be willing to step outside the box a little bit.
I definitely second that, because for me personally, I came into school not really knowing what I wanted to do. I've always loved working with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. However, I feel like every semester that we go through, I change what I want to do. So we had our MSK semester and I was like, oh, I want to do hand therapy. And then we had our PEDS semester and I'm like, oh, kids are so fun to work with. And so definitely keeping that open mind, and that kind of connects back to, you know, what we talked about in the beginning of just OT, there's just so many possibilities. And I really feel like that won't, your true specialty probably won't, you know, solidify until after level 2 fieldwork, and maybe even then after your first job. And so just having that open mind is super important just in the profession in general. So I love that y'all shared that. So going off of open mind, kind of I wanted y'all to share, if you're willing, about just some of the characteristics that you think make a great OT.
You have to have really strong skills of observation. Be able to pick up if a movement's not fluid or controlled, or if something looks off and how an occupation is being completed. I think willing to look stuff up too, if you don't quite understand what you're seeing. Again, asking questions, looking for more information.
Yeah, that's another really good question. I had a thought and then it just floated away there for a second.
You're a really great OT, so you could just explain your characteristics.
Well, you know, I think being willing to look at a person holistically is really one of the key characteristics as an OT, is you have to know how to look at a person in the whole, because maybe what you're seeing right then and there isn't really the full story. Their pain, if they're coming in with pain and you're not seeing any signs or symptoms of pain physically, maybe there's something emotionally that's going on. So you really have to learn how to do those observations and ask those questions to your client to be able to really see the full picture. You know, whenever I am working with a client for an assistive technology specifically, I need to know what their home life looks like. I need to know what their environment looks like. Because the last thing I want to do is say, okay, I think this client would benefit from a powered wheelchair, but they don't have a way to get this powered wheelchair into their home. Okay, well, what else? Or they don't have a way to be able to get it from point A to point B. So you really need to be able to ask those questions and need to be able to get a good clinical, a profile of your client, to be able, that occupational profile that we talk about all the time in class, to be able to be the best therapist for your clients.
Absolutely. And I just want to say to our listeners, I hope you were taking notes, because that is an elevator speech right there. Okay, so we'll stop bugging you now. I have one more question for you, and it's just something to leave our listeners with. So what is one thing you wish more people knew about occupational therapy?
Well, if I use an old punchline, that I'm not going to help you find a job, or I'm not going to help you to weave a basket. I think that it goes to something that Dr. Blankenship said, that we really look at people holistically. We consider the entire person and what their needs are, regardless of the area of the need, and we work creatively to try to make that better for those people, those individuals.
I mean, I think I've said it occupational therapy is cool. We have a really cool job, and I wish more people got to experience just how much fun we have as therapists. You're constantly being creative. You're constantly thinking on your feet. You never have the same day. And I think that's something that's really cool about our profession. And just, you know, you're going to show up to your career. You're going to show up to your job, and it's not going to look the same. No 2 days are ever going to be the same. So you're never bored. I think that's really just, like you say, there's the punchline. I'm not going to help you find a job. Yes, I can be a pediatric OT. There's no, I don't teach kids how to interview or how to get a job. I just teach kids how to be kids and how to live life and how to be the best that they can be, and help them be able to play with their peers, help them to be able to interact with their teachers, help them to be able to play with their siblings and just enjoy life.
Awesome. Well, thank y'all so much for taking the time to talk with us. You know, it can be so easy as students to get just so stressed out because of school and stuff, and the passion that y'all have for our field that you share with us in class and that you've shared with us here now is just rejuvenating, and it reminds us of our why we chose occupational therapy. So we thank you for everything that you do for us. You've both played huge roles in our didactic years, and we're so excited to take the knowledge that you've given us here into the, you know, level 2 field works and into our work in the future. So we appreciate y'all a lot, and we're so glad we could have you on as our guest. Thank you.
Thank you guys for having us, and look forward to seeing what you guys become and just the amazing OTs that you guys will become.